Jesus was led to the cross to be executed, along with two other men who were both criminals. On a hill called the Skull, all three of them were crucified. One criminal on his right, and the other on his left. As they erected his cross, he looked at his executioners and said,
"Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they're doing."
One of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him. "Aren't you the Messiah? Save yourself and us." But the other criminal rebuked him, saying, "Don't you fear God? We are punished justly, but this man has done nothing wrong." Then he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Jesus answered him,
"Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise."
Darkness came over the whole land, for the sun had stopped shining. Jesus' mother, Mary, stood near his cross. He saw her there, along with his disciple John. Looking at them both with love, he said to his mother,
"Woman, here is your son."
Hey, welcome to Kamloops Alliance. My name is Chris. Thanks for being here this weekend. A special welcome to you. Again, this season is just so strange. And so if you are outside of Kamloops, in our province, in our nation, even around the world, we're getting people around the world tuning in. I'm just glad you're here. Thanks for being a part of our extended family in this way. Also, if you're looking for a new church, if some transition's going on, you're checking Jesus out, we're so privileged that you would trust us with your search, or even with potentially a new home church. We'd love to be able to serve you, love you in whatever way that we possibly can. So welcome. I'm glad you are here. I learned to preach in different ways. One of the ways was at Ambrose University in Calgary through a homiletics class. A homiletics is basically, here's how you preach. So here's a structure in how you preach, and here's how you deliver a sermon, all that sort of stuff. And I remember one of my first sermons I ever delivered was behind A.W. Tozer's pulpit. If you don't know A.W. Tozer, he was a pastor, theologian, author, and really was kind of prolific within the Christian and Missionary Alliance, which is our denomination. And because this is an alliance school, they had A.W. Tozer's pulpit there. So I'm a little young punk, and I got my sermon prepared, and I stand behind this enormous wood pulpit, like A.W. Tozer's pulpit. It was quite a feeling. There's other famous preachers that had their pulpit. Charles Haddon Spurgeon in London, the prince of preachers. He had not so much a pulpit, but like a preaching rail, and his church was filled and he'd preach. And so famous preachers have their pulpits. And Jesus had his pulpit, but it wasn't a wooden pulpit. It was actually a wooden cross. And so this sermon series is famous last words, where Jesus preaches from the cross. And so this is week three. The first week, Pastor Tim did such a great job in explaining and leading us through Jesus's statement of forgive them, for they know not what they're doing. Last week, I did, today you'll be with me in paradise. And this week, we are continuing in John chapter 19. So I'd invite you to grab your Bibles as we continue listening to Jesus preaching from his cross, where he says, "Woman, behold your son," to Mary. And then to John, he says, "Here is your mother." So John chapter 19, as we get into this together, leading up to Easter, we just think it's so foundational for us as a community to stare at the cross. So John chapter 19, I'll set it up for us. It says this: "When the soldiers crucified Jesus, they took his clothes, dividing them into four shares, one for each of them, with the undergarment remaining. This garment was seamless, woven in one piece from top to bottom. 'Let's not tear it,' they said with one another. 'Let's decide by lot who will get it.' This happened that the scripture might be fulfilled that said, 'They divided my clothes among them and cast lots for my garments.'" So we are introduced to the executioners hired by the Roman government, the Roman Empire, to put people to death. They were professionals at doing this. And what they're doing is they're casting lots or throwing dice for the clothes of the criminal, which in this case would be Jesus, falsely accused, of course. So we have executioners throwing dice for the remains or the garments of Jesus. Then we are introduced to four other people in direct contrast to these soldiers. It says this in verse 25, near the cross of Jesus, notice the word near the cross of Jesus stood his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. You have four soldiers throwing dice, and you have four women being faithful, watching, mourning, grieving, as they are watching Jesus be murdered. It says this in verse 26, when Jesus saw his mother there and the disciple whom he loved. And so the camera then now zooms in on two of these people, Jesus's mother, Mary, and the disciple whom he loved, which is John's own way of addressing himself in his own gospel of John. And so it's his mom and his best friend. It says, and the disciple whom he loved, standing nearby again. They are standing near the cross, near the cross. Why are they standing near the cross? Well, because as Jesus is pinned on the cross in his wrists and either his ankles or his the top of his feet, he is dying of asphyxiation. And any time that he needs to take a breath, he has to push down on the nail driven through his feet to draw a breath. So speaking is difficult. So they draw near to him, both because they love him and because they want to hear him speak to them. It's quite a profound statement. And here's what he says. He says to her, Mary, woman, here is your son. This is not a term of disrespect. Culturally, this is what they would say. This is how Jesus addresses his mom in John chapter 2. This is not a term of disrespect at all. But he says, woman, here is your son. And to the disciple, here is your mother. What Jesus is doing is he's introducing his mother and his best friend. Here is your son, John. And John, here is your mother together. There are two ways to read this moment that Jesus has on the cross. One is just a plain literal reading of it, which we'll unpack, and the other is more symbolic. And so that's what I want to do for the rest of our time, address the two readings of this, both the literal and then the symbolic. Let's start with the literal. Jesus, in this moment, is talking to his mother and his best friend. Woman, here is your son, referring to John, and to the disciple, here is your mother. What's going on? It's a plain literal reading of this. What's going on? Well, simple. It's a Jewish son taking care of his mother in his death. It was actually quite well known at the time that the Roman Empire would allow these criminals before their death to settle their estate, to make sure that things were in place, that when they died, that things would be set up for them, their family, and all that sort of stuff. And this is kind of that legal moment for Jesus on the cross where he is taking care of those who will be left behind. You see, Mary, his mother, was a widow. We don't know that for sure, but most likely was a widow at this point. The average lifespan of somebody in the first century was between 40 and about 55 years old. At the time of Jesus's birth, Joseph just culturally would have been a lot older than Mary, and so he has passed on. This leaves the responsibility to Jesus as the eldest son in his family to take care of his mother. And also, by doing this, he is honoring one of the commandments, the good commandments, and we find in Exodus and Deuteronomy, one of the Ten Commandments, that we need to honor your father and your mother. And as a good Jewish son, this is what is going on in this moment. At the end, I love it. It says, from that time on, this disciple took her into his home. That John, Jesus's best friend, takes Mary into his home, loves her, feeds her, watches her age, and watches her pass on as well. That Jesus, in this moment, simply caring for the ones that he loves dearly. You know, see, this is what Jesus has been doing for his entire ministry. He's been providing for the ones who he loves. Think about the story. In Luke chapter 8, there's a story of a bleeding woman, and this bleeding issue, this blood issue, would have been really detrimental to her community. She would have been estranged from everybody due to Jewish purity laws. She has gone to doctor after doctor after doctor trying to get this issue resolved. She seeks Jesus out in the middle of the crowd, touches the hem of his garment, and receives healing just like that. And Jesus, in his love for the ones who follow him, provides what this lady has been searching for forever. He provides a restoration for her back into community. Such a beautiful story. Think about the feeding of the 4,000 in Matthew chapter 15. It's interesting that Jesus finds himself in the Decapolis. All right, this is important for us. You maybe miss it, but for him and for the time, man, this is really, really important. The Decapolis, the Deca, which is 10, the polis is city, the 10 cities. This is where under Alexander the Great, he sent all of the Gentiles. If you were a Jewish person in the Galilee area, you would be in the tri-cities of Capernaum, Bethsaida, and Chorazin. That was where the Jews hung out. The Gentiles, they were sent to the Decapolis. This is in the modern area called the Golan Heights in Israel. This was the Decapolis, and Jesus was with those people in the Decapolis, the people that the Jews would never hang out with. It's actually the disciples who say, we need to get going. These people are hungry. We need to get going. Let's leave. And Jesus says, no, they have needs. And so what does he do? Is he feeds 4,000 people, providing for those people their very need. See, it's been true of Jesus in his entire ministry of meeting needs, of providing for the ones that he loves. And it is here in this beautiful, tender, grotesque moment when he is dying on a cross that he's providing not just for the other people, but for his mother, his family, the ones that he loves the most. See, it's in Mary's moment of her greatest need that Jesus provides. Woman, behold your son. Here's John. And John, behold your mother. Would you take care of her till the day that she dies? What a moment. As he is suffering, as he is slowly suffocating to death, he is not thinking about his own needs, but rather about his mom. Think about Mary's experience in all of this. It says in the Gospel of Luke, as she's watching this unique boy grow up, it says that she's pondering these things in her heart. Watching him grow up, being fully God and yet fully human. Now she's watching her son being murdered on a cross, embarrassed. It's obscene. Imagine her need. And it's in this moment where Jesus understands her need and provides for her. It's been true of those people in Matthew 15 and in the woman with the bleeding issue. It's true of Mary. And it's also true, listen to me, it's also true of those of us who follow Jesus today that he thinks of you and provides for your needs, maybe at your greatest moment of need. For some of us, you're like, oh, I don't know if that's actually true. Maybe you're a skeptic tuning in. You're like, I don't understand. Or you just don't really see that Jesus has provided you anything. Well, let me just remind you of something about this moment. Jesus is dying, and he's dying for a reason. He's allowing these Roman officials, he's allowed the Jewish officials to put him on the cross. Why is he doing this? We're reminded in Colossians chapter 2, where it says, he forgave us all our sins, having canceled the charge of our legal indebtedness, which stood against us and condemned us, he has taken it away, nailing it to the cross. How has Jesus provided for you? Listen to me. He has provided for you by his death. By his death. That God is holy and we are not. And that Jesus on the cross lives a life in his life that you could not live. There are over 600 commandments of how we should live a pure and holy life in the Old Testament. And you have not kept hardly any of them. Jesus, on your behalf, he keeps them for you. And this is this legal indebtedness that you have broken broken the law of a holy God, and you are unable to pay it back. You can never do it. And so the gospel of Jesus is that he comes on your behalf. He comes at your greatest moment of need with your sin, and he dies a terrible death on your behalf. Why? So that you could be forgiven. That your greatest need today, listen, you may have lots of great needs, and I'm not trying to discount them or discredit them or dilute those needs, but your greatest need today is a spiritual need, that without Jesus, you are fractured from a holy God. But in this moment, Jesus is providing for you what you need, the remedy to the sin of your life and the estrangement that you have with God. And he has nailed it to the cross, this legal indebtedness that you have. He's nailed it to the cross. So listen to me clearly. Jesus has provided for you a relationship with God on the cross. And that is something to celebrate today. But he's also provided for all of our other needs. Yes, your greatest need, but all of our other needs too. All of our other needs. I think about how he's provided for our church in this pandemic. I mean, this has been such a hard time in a lot of ways, leadership-wise. We're disconnected. I'm in our sanctuary right now. It's echoey. There's no chairs. This has been so hard. And as I look back, man, we have taken steps forward as a church. Why? Not because I'm a great leader, because we have a great staff, although we have a great staff and I'm trying to be a great leader, but because he's provided. He loves our church more than any of us. Do you understand that? He loves and has provided for our church. We've had staff members come on board in this season. Why? Because he's provided for our needs, and it is beautiful. I love the fact that KAC has over 70 years of stories of how Jesus has provided for our needs. 70 years of history. Not all of those years have been bright and cheery. Some of them have been really difficult. But Jesus loves our church and has provided what we have needed. And he's provided through great people, perhaps people like you, who have been on board through those bright and cheery days and maybe through not so bright and cheery days at this church. But it is through you and your generosity and your service and your commitment to this church that's made it what it is. And who's done that? Jesus has provided our need. As he is doing for his mom, he does for us in our salvation, and he will do for our church in the future as well. Praise be to God. So that is just a literal reading of the text. But I believe there's something more going on that we could miss. And I need to be careful that I don't push this too far, as some people do. But I do believe that there's something else going on. Let me read it again. In John chapter 19, it says, "When Jesus saw his mother there and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to her, 'Woman, here is your son.' And to the disciple, 'Here is your mother.'" Here's the thing, is that they're not actually mother and son. They're from different families. What is Jesus doing here? Jesus is transcending normal familial ties, and he is making a new community here. He is making a new community. His mother and his best friend now becomes a family. What? By blood? No, but by the cross. See, normally, the younger brother of Jesus, or younger brothers, whoever was alive, would be responsible for this moment of care for Mary. But they have all abandoned him. By just searching through the scriptures, we know that Jesus had four brothers and a few sisters, but they're gone. They're not here. And so Jesus, in this moment, he brings his best friend and his mother together, bringing them into a new community, a community of the church, that people who are not related come together as one at the cross. Now, some Catholic theologians and thinkers take this a little bit too far and really elevate Mary's status here as the mother of the church. And I don't think that's what's going on, but I do believe there is a symbolic thing that is going on, that Jesus is establishing a new community at the cross, that family ties are transcended by the Spirit. By the cross. So one theologian says this, I love it. "From the cross downward, the one exalted on the cross grounds his church under the cross." That the church here, in a symbolic way, is formed under the cross. And so what I want to do is I want to talk to us about a cross-centered community. That we, as the church, are found at the cross as as Mary and John are found here in a new family. So I want to talk to you about a cross-centered community. That yes, at the cross we come and find Jesus, but hold on, we also find each other. So what is a cross-centered community like? I got three ideas. The first one is a cross-centered community loves. As we have been loved, we love each other. As we have been loved, we love each other. This is an identifying marker of a Christ-centered community. Jesus summarizes this whole Christian thing, if you're checking this out. He summarizes it for us. What does it mean to be a Christian? Well, you love God with all your heart, and you love your neighbor as yourself. It's pretty simple. And he uses this, you love God with all of your heart. For us in the West, we think of the heart as kind of the Disney heart, you know, follow your heart. It's the seat of your emotions. But biblically, it's more than that. Biblically, it's like the rudder of your life. It's the seat that drives your entire life. And so Jesus is saying, love God with your entire being, your entire being. It's not just emotions. It's everything, your entire self, that your love of Jesus must be paramount to anything else in your life. So I've said this to you, and I will continue to say this to you. I love Christianity because it says you love things, and love is a good thing. It's not the negation of desire, it's the rightly ordered desires that matter the most. And so what Jesus is saying is you need to love me more than anyone else. There's a great moment in the Gospel of Luke. It says this, Luke chapter 14, verse 25. It says, large crowds were traveling with Jesus, and turning to them, he said, if anyone comes to me and does not hate father and mother, wife and children, brothers and sisters, yes, even their own life, such a person cannot be my disciple. Wow, talk about a downer, all these crowds. And Jesus says to them, look, if you don't hate your own family and yourself, you cannot be my disciple. Oh, Mike, what is he saying? Is he saying that you actually have to hate your own family and yourself? No, 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 no. He's saying your love for your family must look like hate in your comparison to your love for me. Do you understand that? Your love for your family must look like hate in your comparison of love for me. That the cross is asking, Jesus on the cross is asking us, what do you love? What do you really love? We talk about the practices here. You better not love the practices, because that's not what it's about. This is about a love affair with Jesus, that he has died for your sin, for your rebellion, for your lies, for your adultery, for your betrayal. He's died for all of that. It has come at a cost that you could be with God. And that should overflow in love. And so do you love Jesus, or do you love the idea of him? Do you love Jesus, or do you love the morality that he gives you and your family? That all of our lives, the seat of our lives, we have to love Jesus. And you will love something. You were made to love something. And this is how you change, as we stare at the dying Savior on the cross and to see his love for you. That a cross-centered community loves Jesus. And we love each other as we have been loved. We love each other. That's an identifying marker of a Christ-centered, cross-centered community. Second one is that a cross-centered community reconciles. As we have been reconciled, as our record of debt has been nailed to the cross, as we are reconciled to God through Christ, we reconcile with each other. So yeah, man, as a church, we want to get it right. We want to love each other really well. But here's the thing, we mess up. So if you're checking church Christianity out and you're like, man, this is a group of scrubbed up, perfect people that they all get it right. Listen to me, that I love you, but you're naive. If you've ever spent any time in church, you realize that we don't always get this right. But listen, when we don't get it right, we are quick to reconcile. Own our stuff. We are quick to seek understanding and forgiveness because of what we have received through Jesus, we now give to each other. One of many hard realities of this pandemic is the toll that it has taken on marriages. I think this pandemic has been an accelerant for whatever has what was happening before the pandemic. So I think if you own a business, organizational leadership, if you were healthy and good going into the pandemic, that's been accelerated. If there was dysfunction, that's been accelerated. And I think it's true of marriages as well. If there was a sense of togetherness and unity and good practices and prayer and all, that has been accelerated in this pandemic. But if there was any crack in your foundation, it has been accelerated through and you are barely holding on right now. That there is a weight that you are carrying right now. If you're honest, you're thinking about getting out right now because it is just so hard and messy. And the place and the person that you want to feel the most safe and comfortable with is a person that you actually maybe detest the most right now. There is a grinding in your life and there is not a love. There's actually wanting to escape this with more work, with whatever it is. And this is true. And what I would plead with you is to bring your marriage to the cross. To bring your marriage to the cross, because in and of yourself, you cannot forgive, you cannot seek to understand right now, but bringing your marriage to the cross where you see somebody who in self-sacrificial love has given themselves to you, that maybe you could do that to your spouse again. That right now it seems hopeless, but I'm pleading with you, for you, on your behalf, that it is possible. It is possible to rearrange, that there are better days ahead if you can persevere in this time and find reconciliation with the one that you love or thought you did anyway. And this covenant that Jesus is doing in his blood is a covenant that we represent to our spouse. And it is not one of entitlement or what I can get, but one of service. One of loving the other, being self-forgetful. And so when I officiate weddings, if you've ever been a part of a wedding, at the end, I always say, those whom God has brought together, let no one separate. And it's kind of this nice pithy thing that we say, but listen to that. Those whom God has brought together, let no one separate. In other words, the hope of your marriage right now is that maybe you have let go of your spouse, but listen to me. Jesus is the one at the cross that is holding you together, that there is hope for you in the middle of the rubble and the pain and the confusion and the hurt and the fights, that there is pain. Those whom God has brought together, that he is holding you together right now, even though you may want to let go. I'm pleading with you, don't let go. Continue to press forward. Why? Because a cross-centered community and a cross-centered marriage reconciles. Because we have been reconciled, we can do that to the ones in our lives. Man, may it be so of our church, and may it be so of your marriage, that if you believe in Jesus, this is possible. And if you are married right now, you don't know Jesus. You don't know Jesus, and it is a mess, and you're afraid of what it's going to cost you and your family, your kids. Man, come to Jesus today. He can give you the inner resources and the strength, the paradigm, the worldview in order that you can reshape your family history. Man, I've seen it. It's possible. So I'm pleading with you and for you in this way. So cross-centered community, what do? We love, we reconcile, and we serve. We serve each other. As we have been served, we serve. As we've been loved, as we've been reconciled, as we've been served, we serve each other. This is what an identifying marker of a Christ-centered community. Who do we serve? We serve our families. We serve our church. And we serve our world. Serve. The people who have followed the way of Jesus, being transformed by the cross, re-identify themselves, not as an influencer, not as a successful person, but as a servant. One of the ways you see that in the New Testament is this guy named Paul, whose life is radically converted, hated Christians, killed them, persecuted the church, radically converted to Jesus. And he writes what we have, like two-thirds of our New Testament. The way that he opens one of his letters to the Romans is Paul, a servant of God. Think about how drastic it would be if you and I viewed ourselves as servants of each other, not as entitled members or adherents to Kamloops Alliance, but servants of one another. Servants of Jesus, first and foremost, but servants of one another. A cross-centered community who finds ourselves at the cross, is identified by the story of the cross, have no room for entitlement or pride. How can you have pride when you are watching Jesus bleeding out for you on the cross? There's no sense of entitlement. Oh, the church isn't feeding me. I don't get the songs I want. There is no sense of entitlement of a cross-centered community. Why? Because we become servants. So this is our vision of, as a church. Our vision as a church is we want to serve all people. We want all people to become fully devoted followers of Jesus. All people. So what does that look like? It means all people. All people who are made in the image of God. We're hungry for that. So when I got here, I started a ministry called Marketplace Leaders. We want to influence the business people, the marketplace leaders of our city. And we've, to varying degrees of success, been encouraged with that and seeing that influence happening. It's been amazing to see Christians and non-Christians engage with marketplace leaders. But now we're venturing into something new with the indigenous population of our city. All people. When I mean all people, I mean all people. That we will serve all people of our city, marketplace leaders, indigenous people, the old, the young, whoever. We want to say to anybody the good news of Jesus. So think about this, a community, think about this in our world, a community, a cross-centered community that loves and reconciles and serves. This will set us apart. In a polarized, fighting world, this will set us apart. And I will say this again. I've said it before. I will keep saying it to you and I as a reminder. The new apologetic for us. Yes, we need to think well about the Gospels and about evil and suffering. And can you trust the Bible? Yes, 100%. But the new apologetic is the beauty of the church. I will say it is the beauty of a community found at the cross that loves, reconciles, and serves one another. Don't forget that. Don't forget that as we reemerge from this, don't forget who we are. We are a cross-centered community. This has been true of the community of disciples who have followed Jesus right from the beginning. We have been a peculiar people, strange. What are these people? So even in like two or three generations after the ministry of Jesus, probably a century after the ministry of Jesus, there's some rumors swirling around of this peculiar group of people called Christians. They follow this way of Jesus of Nazareth. They're weird, they're strange. And so there's a whole bunch of rumors swirling around. And there's a letter that we have that was circulating between 130 and 200 AD. This letter, or it's called the Epistle to Diognetus, and it was one of the earliest letters that we have that's defending the Christian community. It's a brilliant letter. Church history is so helpful for us. So the first part of this, it's a lengthy quote, I won't say all of it, but the first part of this quote is the author, who we don't know, writing to Diognetus, who we also don't really know, but we have most of this letter intact. He's talking about how Christians are like everybody else. They live in the same place, they look the same, they speak the same, they are citizens of the Roman Empire. But then he says this, nevertheless, the organization of their community does exhibit some features that are remarkable and even surprising. For instance, though they are residents at home in their own countries, their behavior there is more like transients. Though destiny has placed them here in the flesh, they do not live after the flesh. Their days are passed on earth, but listen, their citizenship is above in the heavens. They obey the prescribed laws, but in their own private lives, they transcend the laws. They show love to all the men, and all men persecute them. They are misunderstood and condemned, yet by suffering death, they are quickened into life. They are poor, yet making many rich, lacking all things, yet having all things in abundance. They repay curses with blessings and abuse with courtesy. For the good they do, they suffer stripes, as evildoers. Listen to that. The earliest Christians following Jesus under enormous persecutions stood out. Why? Because they loved those who persecuted them. They were committed to them, to each other in the church, that they found their citizenship in heaven. They knew they were just passing through, that we have always been a peculiar people. Why? Because we are community found at the cross. As Jesus institutes this new community by saying, "Woman, here is your son," and to the disciple, "Here is your mother." Here we are, the church found at the cross. So what am I asking you to do for us as a community? Would you be the voice, the hands, and the feet of Jesus to each other right now, loving, reconciling, serving one another? For you whose marriages are struggling, would you stop everything? Would you get together and ask each other, is there any hurt that needs to be talked about? Is there any sin that I need to own or confess? Would you get real with one another? And would you roll up your sleeves and start to work again? For those of us who just need care right now, in this pandemic, would you be reminded that in Mary's greatest moment of need, Jesus provides? And would you look for that in your life right now? Reflect on those times this year in your life where Jesus has provided what you have needed. What we're going to do now is we're going to have some questions that will kind of shape this next few minutes for you. If you're alone, reflect on them. Pray. If you are with your family, the people you love, friends in your home, which I guess is not allowed, so hopefully that's not happening. But anyway, you could talk about this with the people in the room right now. And then what we're going to do is we have a reflection song. The song you may not know, that's okay. We want you to reflect on this. You can sing along if you want, but it's more of a reflection piece for you to enjoy and for you to think through what we've just talked about. Thanks for coming. We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.